Cool. I hope that you are ready for another message in this series on the way of Jesus, where we really look at the way that Jesus lived and see his practices, his lifestyle. You know, not only his teachings and the miracles that he did, but we also look at his lifestyle. How did Jesus live? How did and what can we learn from that? Because we are disciples of Jesus. We are students. We're followers. We want to imitate the way that he lives. I loved your sweater today. What would Jesus do? And that's some of you may not be from that time when everyone was wearing one of those bracelets with, what would Jesus do? The complete question is actually, what would Jesus do if he was living your life? You know, because Jesus was, we think, okay, if we want to live like Jesus, we have to like evangelize everyone and do all these miracles and go here and go there and kind of live as a rabbi. No, that was, Jesus lived as a rabbi. We live as, other people in a completely different time. And we are living our lives. I'm living with my family, and some of you are students or whatever stage of life you're in. The question is, how would Jesus live my life, live this life, if he was living my life? Because you're living your life. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting on the floor with my son. I work part time. My wife works full time, and so I get to spend a lot of time with our children, which is fantastic. And I was sitting on the floor with him. He's now 9 months old exactly today. He's longer out than in. The story was when he was 8 months, so then he couldn't crawl yet, so playing with him on the floor is a little bit boring sometimes, because they can't really do too much yet, and so I was getting a little bored. And I was checking my phone the whole time. Every 2 minutes I was checking my phone, like, is there any news update, is there anything I can, like, and I noticed that, and I was wondering, like, there's nothing urgent going on right now. There's nothing that needs my immediate attention. I'm just seeking distraction because I'm a little bored. I know, it's confessions of a pastor, confessions of a dad. I think 2023 is going to be my year when I earn the Daddy of the Year award. But this year, I already blew it. It's weird how we seek distraction so quickly when we're a little bit bored. You know, in the year 2007, three things happened that changed the world. First of all, Steve Jobs released the iPhone. Then Facebook went public and Twitter. And so since then, we really live in the digital age of constant distraction. There's always something that can distract. And I don't know that most of you are off Facebook and onto Instagram or TikTok or whatever new crazy thing you Gen Z's invented. But I cannot imagine my life anymore without my iPhone. Actually, the other day, I came here for a meeting, and I was running a bit late, and at home, I couldn't find my phone. I had to leave without, because otherwise I would be too late, and I had to open up here. And I felt, it was like I was missing a limb, almost. What if something happens, then, you're without your phone. And I'm actually old enough to remember life without an iPhone. And some of you may not be. I remember what it was like to go online via the landline at home on your home PC. And you had to wait for 5 minutes, hearing all kinds of weird noises coming from the modem, to go online. And then you would occupy the landline, which is a big deal because you didn't have a mobile phone yet. So the whole house couldn't be reached. To receive email. And so it wasn't all that practical then. I still remember this time. My first phone I got was when I was 16. And it did not have an internet connection or anything like that. So I remember very well what it was like to live life without a smartphone. But somehow I got so used to it, I can't imagine my life without it anymore. Research has shown that our attention span in the last 20 years has dropped from 12 seconds, from 12 seconds to 8 seconds. By comparison, a goldfish has an attention span of 9 seconds. So we're not doing great. We're not doing it. Something is happening. It's not good for us. In spite of all the technology that is supposed to make our lives better, you know, less complicated, it save us time, somehow it never feels like we have enough time. There's always something else we can do. There's always something else that we can occupy our attention with. Life should be simpler. It should be full of leisure. There should be less hurry. But instead, there's more. Hurry, anxiety, burnout at a very young age. All of these things have rapidly increased in our world over the last couple of decades. And of course, there's a complex set of reasons around this. It's not only iPhones. That I know I'm not that, you know, simplistic of a thinker. And so I don't know exactly what's behind it. I don't think anyone knows exactly and knows how to explain all of that. But I think it is fair to say that the overall combination of digital distraction, of the expectation that you should always be busy and productive, and the overwhelming reality of endless opportunities. So if you don't make something of your life, then it really is your own fault, that idea. I think the combination of all of that is having an ongoing destructive effect on our souls. You know, we have a soul, we have an innermost being that is suffering under this way of living, of always seeking distraction, of always keeping yourself occupied with something, of always using every little moment to seek distraction, find something, listen to something. In the age of distraction, it seems almost impossible to develop a healthy inner life. And so today I want to look with you at a practice from the life of Jesus that will help you to develop a healthy inner life. Now, of course, Jesus did not have an iPhone. Lucky him. But do think about it. He ministered for a period of 3 years where he like the Gospels that describe the life of Jesus, they only cover 3 years. So in those 3 years, he was ministering the kingdom. Imagine, like, he was constantly living with very high stakes, obviously, with very high demands. You know, people came from all over bringing their sick and asking for advice and this and that. There was constantly people wanted his attention. Of course, he was living with constant heavy opposition, you know, of the religious authorities and all of that. And he had a literal deadline. So there was something at stake for him. Yet we never see Jesus hurried, stressed out, anxious, or anything like that. And I think this has something to do with Jesus' relation with the lonely place. Last week we talked about the way of community. We talked about how important it is to live connected to others, to be, yeah, not live alone, but live in relationship with others. And that's how we grow. We can't, you know, grow as a disciple all by ourselves. We need to be connected to others. Today, perhaps I'm giving the counterpart to that, emphasizing the importance of alone time, of the lonely place. I'm going to read two verses to you. Mark 1, verse 35. And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. So this is describing Jesus withdrawing from community. Peter is the source for Mark. He woke up Peter, otherwise we wouldn't have known this. And he went to this desolate place to pray. He withdrew from community to be alone and to be with God. So it's in a sense a counterpart to last week, where we learned that it's important to live in community, to grow in our relationship with God. Today we focus more on how we need to be alone with God to grow in our discipleship, in our relationship with him. Luke 5, verse 15 and 16 says, great crowds gathered to hear him, and he healed of their infirmities. But he would withdraw to desolate places and pray. These are just two examples out of many examples in the Gospels, where we see that Jesus is withdrawing, intentionally withdrawing from the crowds, from his disciples, from whomever, to be alone, to be with God. And so it's quite clear that this is a pattern. These were not just a few occasions where you're like, I need some alone time. No, this is a lifestyle choice from Jesus. He intentionally woke up early. I don't know how he did that without an alarm clock, but he woke up early when it was still dark to be alone, to find that alone time, withdraw, to be with his Father. And in the passages we just read, there's the word that is used for that desolate place is eremos. And this word, it's a Greek word that means kind of desolate place or solitary place. Sometimes it means desert or wilderness. And so in some ways we see it translated differently. But it's really just interpretation, what we guess it was. Anytime he would go out to be alone, it would be at some place where he could be up on a mountain or near a lake or some quiet place where he could be alone, where he'd withdraw to pray. In the Bible, the eremos, the wilderness, the desolate place, the desert, it really has two faces. In one way, it's a place of, you know, desolation, or even of desperation, of vulnerability, physically, spiritually. The wilderness really is a place of survival. It's difficult. Like we see the people of Israel traveling through the wilderness onto the promised land, and it's a time of shaping and difficulty and of survival in a way. And all kinds of places. Like the desert was also the place where the demons lived. And so one of the traditions for the people of Israel was that they would put their sins on a goat and send it into the desert. Like that's for Bezalel, like the king of the demons. Like he should treat we sacrifice it to him. So the wilderness is this desolate place. It's not safe. It's where you're vulnerable. Yet on the other hand, eremos is also a place of encounter with God. Think about the encounters on Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. Think of John the Baptist who ministered in the wilderness. So these are two different sides of the same word, of that place, that lonely place, that desolate place. And in Matthew 4, where we see Jesus going into the wilderness to fast and to pray, and then he has a face-off with the devil. It's also in the eremos, and we kind of see both sides of that story there. Now, maybe all this talk about the lonely place makes you really nervous, because we are just coming out of a season of lockdown again, out of 2 years with lockdowns off and on, and a real lack of community. And maybe for you, this was a really, really difficult time where you came here to study or to work, you know, away from family, away from your home country, and then you're in this foreign city where you know no one, and it's in lockdown, so there's no opportunity to get to know anyone, and it's lonely. It's a very lonely place. It's a place of desolation. You want it to be over. And I feel that. I'm an extrovert. I need people around me. So the last 2 years have been difficult for me as well. Like I want to be in community. I want to connect. I don't like too much alone time. But I will make the case today that all of us have a deep need for silence and solitude, for that lonely place. And solitude is different from loneliness. The big difference is that solitude is chosen, loneliness is not. Loneliness means I want to connect with others, I want to be in community, I want friends, I want people around me, but there's no one, I'm all alone. Solitude is I'm going to withdraw intentionally from other people to be alone, to have some alone time. So there's a difference there. And loneliness is potentially harmful, especially over a long time. You know, stress and anxiety and depression develop. But solitude has all kinds of benefits. Sought out, intentional, alone time. Psychologists have been saying for years that we are living with a lack of silence. Silence is important. It's healthy to have moments of silence in the day, to have times of quiet. Now, the amount of silence and solitude that you need depends on a number of different things. Some of you are introverts, you need a little bit more. Some are extroverts, you may need a little less. Depends on your living circumstances. You have noisy roommates, like five-year-old kids, or what is your job like? You know, what's your personality like? How are you wired? All of these things play a role in that. But all of us need some silence and solitude, the way that Jesus did as well. A lack of silence can actually have a damaging effect on your brain and your overall health. While regular times of silence have proven to lead to lower blood pressure, to boost the immune system, grow new brain cells. I'm taking a lot of alone time because I always feel like I don't have enough brain cells to pester all you smart people. It relieves tension, and it relieves tension in the body, and it improves sleep. In addition, times of undistracted silence, aka solitude, give space for reflection, for creativity, and a deeper awareness of self. So I think that many of us living in the age of distraction have kind of unlearned to do silence and solitude well, to do it productive, to make alone time productive time, and embrace silence and solitude as a place where we can meet with God. You see that in like when I stand at the bus stop waiting for the bus, I pick up my phone and I seek distraction. I want to read something, I want to do something, or I put in my earbuds and listen to some music or whatever when I'm doing that. Like if I can do two things at the same time, I will do it. I seek distraction at any little dull moment when there's nothing going on, because like you fear to sort of stare into the abyss of nothingness. Like, yeah, but what do I do for this 5 minutes? And perhaps it's difficult to do alone time well or do the in-between moments well, because we're talking about the eremos. We're talking about the desolate place, the lonely place, the wilderness. It's uncomfortable. But I want to make the case today that it's also the place where we encounter with God. So we're going to reflect a little bit on something I mentioned earlier, that in Matthew 4, we see both of them coming together. And it's a place where you kind of face your demons, in a sense. Now, not demons in the biblical way, but more in the pop psychology, like the inner turmoil, the difficult things, but also the place of encounter with God. And Matthew 4 we could do a whole sermon series on that chapter alone, because it's very significant. It's Jesus face off with the devil. He's tempting Jesus with lies. And it happens after a period of 40 days of prayer and fasting. Now, this whole scene happens right after Jesus was baptized, the Holy Spirit descends on him, there's a voice from heaven, this is my son who I dearly love. So it's a moment of you know, confirmation, it's really where his life as the Messiah kind of starts. And then we read, then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness, into the eremos, to be tempted by the devil. And after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. Yes, I can imagine. And the tempter, the devil, came to him and said to him, if you are the Son of God. Now, okay, we're not getting into it all. If you are, God just said, you are my son. And the devil, if you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread. And he answered, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And I'm going to read only up to there. There's going to be two more tempting lies that Jesus has to kind of withstand with the word. They're really sort of archetypal lies. There's a lot behind that. I think we did a message on that 2 years ago or something. We're not going to dig into that right now. what I want you to understand that this is happening in the wilderness. This is happening in the eremos. This is happening when Jesus has been alone for 40 days to pray and to fast. Now, chances are that you look at this story and think, man, the devil really gets you when you're in isolation and when you're vulnerable, when you're hungry, when you're grumpy, when, you know, when I fast, I get grumpy first. Like, it's not always, a tranquil experience. So this is when the devil tries to get you. And we see Jesus here in a moment of vulnerability. You know, he's hungry, he's isolated, he's in the desert. But what if we got that wrong? What if we need to look at it at a different way and say, Jesus is having his face off with the devil when he was at his moment of complete strength, of spiritual strength. He had alone time with God for 40 days. He was at a high moment of strength, and he was ready to have a face off with the devil. Bring it on. I will refute you with the truth of the word of God. What if this was a moment of strength for Jesus, not a moment of vulnerability? His body was weak, yes, but his spirit was nurtured, ready to face a direct encounter with the devil. So the solitary place may indeed be a place where you kind of face your demons. I'm using that like as an idea, right? So the face your demon, the face your inner turmoil, the face the things that are going on inside of you. And that's what makes it difficult, but it's also a place of encounter with God. When we take alone time, I don't know if you ever really have like longer periods of alone time, but when you're alone for a while, chances are that the thoughts that are going on, when you do not seek distraction, actually become overwhelming. You may feel things that are happening in your soul that you haven't felt before because you didn't give space for them. And so instead of like alone time, you know, a time of silence and solitude, that it's a tranquil experience of beauty, of just complete rest, it may be very, disrupting. It may be, it may feel... You may feel like there's no rest, like there's unrest in you. There's the doubts, difficult emotions going on. But I think, you know, all of these things are happening beneath the surface anyway. And now at least you get to be aware of them and face them. There's a secular psychologist, Matthew Boker, who has studied solitude. And he says this about it. Productive solitude requires internal exploration, a kind of labor which can be uncomfortable, even excruciating. It might take a little bit of work before it turns into a pleasant experience. But once it does, it becomes maybe the most important relationship anybody ever has, the relationship you have with yourself. So embracing silence and solitude is hard work, but it is important work. Because if you can't do solitude well, so intentional withdrawal to have undistracted alone time, if you cannot do that well, anytime you are alone, you will feel lonely. And then there's a chance that relationships with others actually become part of an unhealthy pattern where you flee to connecting with others, to fun times, having drinks, to this and that, just to not face the inner turmoil that's going on when you're alone and the thoughts that you have and the things going on. Relationships with others, community, can become an unhealthy pattern. The way that Netflix or alcohol or pornography or sports have the potential to become unhealthy coping mechanisms to escape the inner turmoil. Good things, bad things, they all have the potential to become escapes. So part of embracing silence and solitude will be to come face to face with some of the things going on inside that are difficult. But again, it's not just a place where we face our demons. It's also a place of encounter with God. Embracing times of silence and solitude is essential for building a healthy, sustainable, spiritual life. Henry Nouwen goes as far as to say that without solitude, it is impossible to have a spiritual life. To build relationship with God, a personal relationship with God, where he is speaking to us, where we hear his voice, we need to quiet down all the other voices. We need to become quiet to give space for him to speak. And in that, we can both experience the things that are going on deep inside of us and also what he has to say about that. Yeah, I think that sometimes we may think way too complicated about prayer. You know, we see prayer as something like we have to have a list and we have to have the right formulas. And we have to say the right things and do the right things. Sometimes prayer is as simple as inviting God into your thought life. That already is prayer. You give space for that and say, Lord, I'm dealing with some of these things. Like, and I'm a bit of an external processor, so this is the way I sometimes do that. But sometimes it's like taking a walk, thinking about some stuff, and inviting God to walk alongside with you and just share that with him. That's prayer. That's prayer. Ruth Haley Barton, who wrote a book on silence and solitude, An Invitation to Silence and Solitude, she says this: the invitation to solitude, this is a long quote, by the way, the invitation to solitude and silence is just that. It is an invitation to enter more deeply into intimacy of relationship with the one who waits just outside the noise and busyness of our lives for a space within which meaningful connection can occur. It is an invitation to communication and to communion with the one who is always present, even when our awareness has been dulled by distraction. It is an invitation to the adventure of spiritual transformation in the deepest places of our being, an adventure that will result in far greater freedom and authenticity and surrender to God than we ever experienced before. Wow. Now, doesn't this sound like an invitation that we should go on? Invitation to a journey with God in silence, in solitude, to discover, to experience the richness of his presence when we're alone with him and the way that he loves us and the way that he speaks to us and all of that. I want to look at you with you at another example in the Bible where the Eremos, the wilderness, is both a place of turmoil, of desolation, but also a place of encounter with God. The Old Testament prophet Elijah, right after a big high in his ministry, experiences a deep low. First in 1 Kings 18, he has his big showdown with prophets of Baal, and like God showed up in a mighty way. It's a big victory for, you know, the believers in Yahweh versus those in Baal. But right after this happens, he has to flee from the evil queen Isabel. And then he escapes. He flees basically into the wilderness. And there he really has something like a breakdown or like a depressed episode or something like that. He's desperate. But we see God in that wilderness also caring for him, recommissioning him. So again, it's a story of both a wilderness experience where it's desolate, it's difficult, but also a place of encounter with God. And then he goes to Mount Sinai and he spends a night in a cave there. So that's a bit alone. And then we read this. He has this encounter with God and God says, go out and stand before me on the mountain. And as Elijah stood there, the Lord passed by, and a mighty windstorm hit the mountain. It was such a terrible blast that the rocks were torn loose, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, there was a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, there was the sound of a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. So the Lord was in the gentle whisper. So again, the wilderness is a place for inner turmoil, for difficulty, but also a place of encounter with God. And God speaks to him in the silence, in a gentle whisper. And this is why we need to quiet down sometimes. Take times to be alone, to be in silence, so we can hear God's voice. He wants us to come close. In order to hear a whisper, you need to come very close. That's God's invitation. I believe God is inviting you and me to meet him in moments of silence and solitude as well. There's a deep healing and a commissioning that he has for us when we intentionally withdraw from distraction, move into the wilderness, into the eremos, and become silent so that we can hear his gentle whisper. Now, it is about time that we make this a little bit more practical. How then do we do this? So I'm going to first look at some ways we can do this kind of on a daily basis, and then on to more carved out time. So first on a daily basis, I have four tips for you that mostly come from my own life, because, you know, I know me best. And the first one is just enjoy the nothingness of the in-between. So I'm giving you tips from my own life, but I'm still learning. I'm not a great example. So first, enjoy the nothingness of the in-between. So when you're, on the bus or on the bike or in the car or walking or whatever, kind of withstand the temptation to seek distraction, to keep yourself occupied. Any in-between moments, just go for the nothingness of it. When you're in line at a cashier at a grocery store, do not pull out your phone. Do not seek distraction, but just let the nothingness be. It's all right. This is where, you know, you begin a thought life, aka an inner life. Give your brain a break. Leave your phone in your bag. Just be. You know, even like God might even speak to you when you're on the loo. There's no place that he cannot consecrate. Second, that was a bit of a joke, but second, leave the earbuds at home. So Anya, who's fantastic, who's now taking care of her son who doesn't want to sleep, I think. She gave me a Father's Day gift last year, Apple AirPods. They are fantastic, and I use them all the time. And I love listening to music and to sermons and podcasts and books and all kinds of stuff. So, and I see that as important for me to, you know, feed myself with information so that I can spill that over onto you guys. But I've realized that there need to be moments where I do not put them in. Even when I'm alone and doing something I could combine with listening to something, I need to not do that and just embrace the silence. Just do nothing. You know, there's a chance that you can distract yourself from God's voice even listening to worship music or a sermon or whatever. Sometimes to really hear what he has to say to you, you just need to quiet down and give space for the quiet. Give him opportunity to speak to you. Third tip is set a timer. I've come to really enjoy just intentional moments of sitting in my chair and being quiet before the Lord. Actually, I was part of a course 2 years ago on spiritual direction. We did all kinds of spiritual practices like this, including a lot of silence. And the joke was always like when we'd come back after lunch and then, okay, we're going to start with 10 minutes of quiet, of silence. And then I was always getting like, oh, here we go. I don't like this. I'm an extrovert. Like, and so the joke was always, I'm sorry, Kun, we're going to take a moment of quiet. Now I actually do it myself at home or something. I just set a timer for 5 minutes and I calm down. I quiet myself down and say, Lord, here I am. You love me. I love you. Here I am. And nothing. 5 minutes. And it's really good. And I hope that one day I'll make 10 minutes and one day I'll make 15 minutes or something like that. It's a great exercise to just bring yourself before the Lord in the quiet. Fourth tip is get a dog. Now, this is not literal. You don't have to take that literally. But we have had a dog now for 2 years and it has forced me to go on walks. At least twice a day, for like half an hour. And then sometimes, like I've now, my tradition is now that every morning, like after I drop off the kids, I go for a walk and I do it in quiet and I do it intentionally in quiet. I'm not putting anything in. I'm just walking. I'm praying. I'm talking with God. I'm enjoying being outside. Sometimes I run into one of our congregants who's running and I am just before God in silence, and it's great. Now, in all honesty, sometimes for 15 minutes, all that I'm doing is I'm singing the Paw Patrol theme song to myself or something weird like that, because parents know, like, because I hear that theme song at least twice a day. And this is just going through like, or other weird stuff, like quiet's not always fun. It's weird. Like, where's this coming from? Like, but sometimes that's all that happens, but then it does fade. And these are all moments that kind of come back with your attention to God as well. These walks that just the having to go outside and being in the quiet have really a deep soul-shaping effect. You can make that choice as well. Maybe not by getting a dog, but just by intentionally finding moments every day to take a walk, to be in the quiet and enjoy that. Okay, we're almost at the end, guys. Longer stretches of silence and solitude. Now, this is a bit of a underdeveloped practice in my life, so I can't really share from a lot of experience, but I do understand that this is where the real soul shaping stuff happens, when you carve out like a part of the day or full day or weekend for silence and solitude, for retreat, where you take just a bigger period of time for that. So I can't really share. I did this a year and a half ago and I made it to 6 hours, which I thought was pretty good, and I just kind of read my Bible and prayed and journaled and sang weird songs to myself. But it did give me an opportunity to engage with some of the processes that are happening inside. And I think I've only touched the tip of the actual potential of regularly setting time aside for silence and solitude. So just a quick marital tip. This may be a great gift to give to your spouse. Like, why don't you take the day off? I'll take care of the kids and you go do you do whatever you want to do today. You don't have any obligations. Just a quick, just for those married couples out there. Amen. Right, in closing, all of us are called by God to commune with Him. He's a loving Father that has created you to live in intimate relationship with Him. And His invitation to silence and solitude at its deepest level is an invitation to encounter Him and for your soul to find rest in Him. That's His invitation. So I want to end this in the most appropriate way by taking a moment for silence. Let's bring ourselves before God. Say, Lord, here I am. You love me. I love you. Be still and know I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know Be still and be. Amen.